the majority of four, the two Kavanaughs, Levin and Williams, and the two Kavanaughs, Levin and Williams, agreed that the appointment was invalid and that Justice Riley should be ousted from the court. Justice Brickley and I disagreed. For what I always thought were very compelling reasons, as I indicated in my dissent. So I wrote the dissent to the opinion. After the opinion was written and was circulated, the next, we had lost from my point of view. Dorothy had lost and Michigan had lost from my point of view. We were making bad constitutional law, but we were making it. The next maneuver would be to enter an order which would address this unique situation, which had never been addressed in the history of the state. Nor, to our knowledge and the research we did, in any other circumstance in the United States. It would be perfectly clear to me, well, perhaps I shouldn't say perfectly clear, it seemed clear to me that if a federal court was adjudicating the lawfulness of a judicial appointment, that would be one thing, but for the members of our court to adjudicate the qualifications of a colleague to sit was altogether inappropriate. In all events, the next move was the entry of an order and to find a way in which to have the order carried out and obeyed, given appropriate deference to the possibility of an appeal to the United States Supreme Court that she might make.
So, in the middle of this, did not Justice Levin suddenly waver, or there was some in...
You've jogged my memory, and you're right, and I'm mistaken. The vote was not 4-2 at the first conference after the oral argument. The vote was 3-3. We went around the table, and Justices Kavanaugh, Michael, and Kavanaugh Thomas, and Chief Justice Williams were satisfied that Blanchard and Attorney General Kelly were right. Dorothy had to go. Justice Brickley and I felt just the opposite, and Justice Levin did not take a position at the conference that was very strong either way. He was unsure. He was unclear. He thought that this was an extraordinary thing. I could see he was struggling mightily with what he thought was the right thing to do, and he said that inasmuch as he had not been convinced by the plaintiff, which was the plaintiff's burden, that the appointment was unconstitutional, he was unable to say it was, which I remember him saying, leaves me on the side of holding against the Attorney General and, in effect, holding for Dorothy Riley. I thought that was just fine because the result was that the plaintiff had lost, had not proved the governor's case, and Dorothy remained in the court, which, quite aside from my personal preference, I thought squared with constitutional law. That was a Wednesday, as I remember. On Friday, about noon, Levin called a press conference up in the Supreme Court chambers in Michigan, and to my utter amazement, he reversed his position. He said he had done some more work, some more research, and I'm confident he did. He is a man of unimpeachable integrity, in my opinion. But whatever the driving forces were, he saw it differently after a couple of days, realized that there had been great publicity for the result that the court was apparently going to permit her to remain on the bench. Charlie reversed field about noon on Friday, 2 days after our initial decision. That made it 4-2. Dorothy was off the court. You can imagine the pain that she was suffering in this convoluted process. She had been shelved from the court's work within a few weeks after being appointed, denied the opportunity to participate in unrelated cases, had no work to do, had no role to play in the question of the determination of her own destiny, and was... buffeted by the winds of this strange constitutional argument being made both ways, thought she had a decision which would permit her to retain her seat in the court. And 2 days later, Levin changed his mind. She had to have been devastated. So as a result of that, an order had to be entered.
You're welcome.
And the order was entered in a way which was the crowning glory of my judgment, the mishandling of a terribly delicate situation. I was teaching my class in evidence at the Thomas Cooley Law School late in the afternoon of a day, perhaps a week after the Levin switch. Jim Brickley was in his chambers in the Supreme Court in Lansing. I received a message from the switchboard in my classroom and told to call the Chief Justice, which I did immediately, about 10 to 6. And he said, as best I can remember, and I don't quote him, but paraphrasing it, he said, Jim, we've got the four votes here for this order on Dorothy's case, and we're about to enter it here. We're over here in my chambers, and I just thought we ought to notify you about it. Well, I was floored, because during my time in the court, there had never been a circumstance in which the court had ever taken any action, except an emergency action of some kind, in which, save in the presence of the whole seven justices in conference, in the conference room. And I said, remember saying, what's the rush? What do you mean you've got the four votes? The court is a court of, in this instance, six people. He said, well, we've got the votes. There's no use prolonging this thing, so we're going to enter the order. And now, do you want to be heard about it? I said, certainly I want to be heard about it. And needless to say, I was infuriated. So I recessed the class and went over to the Supreme Court, which was only three blocks away, of course, and went into Menin's Chief Justice chambers. And before I got there, I ran into Jim Brickley in the hall, who was coming out of his office, and we compared notes. He had gotten the same phone call 15 minutes earlier and reacted about the way I did. Wondered how could anybody be talking about entering an order when the court wasn't in session. So we went into the Chief Justice's office. It was not a pleasant meeting. I was outraged at the fact that for the first time in my time in the court, I was not convinced that these men of goodwill who saw things differently than I saw things had come to their conclusion in this case utterly without the influence of any extraneous political considerations. I felt the question was so close and the precedent so non-existent to throw a colleague off the court, and the constitutional argument so tenuous that all signals were in the direction of resolving the doubt in favor of the governor's appointment. It was perfectly clear to me that, I shouldn't say perfectly clear, I was beset with a painful suspicion that we wouldn't be proud of what we'd done here. Dorothy was in the Capitol that day. I can't remember why, but we never saw her, of course, even although she was a Supreme Court justice and on the payroll, and in my judgment, perfectly entitled to participate in all the work of the court except this case. She was out at a motel in Grand Ledge where she usually stayed. Dorothy doesn't drive, didn't then, doesn't now, doesn't have a driver's license. Had to be driven to Lansing by her husband or her law clerk or somebody. Hal Hoig, our wonderful court clerk, man of great judgment and diplomacy, was standing over at the corner of the room with his hands behind his back awaiting instructions. A form of order had been prepared, I think by Hal at the Chief Justice's direction. As the six of us stood there in no small amount of pain, the Chief Justice signed the order or caused the clerk to sign the order on behalf of the majority of four, and then I remember saying that I wanted time to write a dissent, both to the content of the order and to the manner in which this was being handled. Brickley and I went over in the corner and conferred, and I think he persuaded me that I was swimming upstream and not to personalize this business, and I think I followed that advice. The order was then handed to a messenger. Forgot who it was. It may have been Hal Hoag himself.